All right, let's go ahead and open up to Matthew 13. We're working our way through these parables. I'm actually taking a little bit longer here than I really planned or intended to begin with, because this program, these parables, really encompass everything that's going to be left in Israel's prophetic program. Everything that's left, he's going to give an explanation of what is going to happen between the first coming of Christ, that's here on our timeline, and the second coming of Christ, when he comes in his wrath and judgment. And it's explaining something he didn't reveal to the prophets, something he kept hidden from the prophets. It says in our passage here, kept hidden from the beginning of the world, not like Paul's mystery, which had been kept secret since the beginning of the world. And God came up with an eternity past before the beginning of creation. These were things he kept secret. He began in Genesis to reveal how he's going to reestablish his glory on earth, but he didn't tell them about this, the prophets, the law and the prophets, about this. And he's going to expand this now. And what we saw as we have worked our way through these parables is that this is, if we're kind of jumping off 1 Peter, where he describes the prophets were looking for what manner of time this time frame is going to be characterized by. They would see, we looked at Isaiah 61 as the classic passage. It said they preach the good news, then comes the day of vengeance, and then comes the kingdom of comfort. And that all happened, one sentence, boom, boom, boom. It looked like it all happened together, that there would be no interval. But then they look at some other passages, and it looked like they couldn't happen all at once. That's what Jesus is revealing here, this manner of time. What is going to characterize this time from the giving of these parables by Jesus here in Matthew and going out to the end of that tribulation period? And so during this time we saw, and we'll just recap it with, this is the first parable, that parable of the sower. We've labeled that. Remember how that parable opens. So you have the unprepared ground, and they had no understanding. How does the parable close of the sower? They, those with prepared ground had understanding. They received the instruction of Christ. So that parable we labeled and we kind of indicated as the time of instruction and understanding. That's kind of the beginning. I think when we looked at these, that's how this is all going to restart. When God restarts his program with Israel, it's going to begin with parable of the sower. They're going to start just throwing out the seed of the kingdom, the word of the kingdom. That's what Jesus had been doing through these first 12 chapters of Matthew, John and Jesus, and in Matthew 10, he even sent the 12 out to do this. They haven't been sowing seed like any real farmer. They've been sowing seed with wild abandon. They've just been taking their seed and they throw it up on the streets. They're throwing it in the weeds. They're throwing it on the rocks. They're throwing it on the good ground. It's spreading everywhere. And that's what that sower is talking about. Jesus in chapter 12 turns away from that wicked generation. He's going to stop sowing the seed with wild abandon, and he's going to turn away from that wicked generation, turn to his generation, his believing, his spiritual family. And that's going to pick up again, and we see this happening in early Acts on the day of Pentecost. What's Peter up there doing? I read an estimate, someone said there would be more than 2 million Jews in Jerusalem and that near surrounding areas during this day of Pentecost from all over the world. And what does Peter go up there and proclaim? Ye men of Israel. He's talking to all of them. And he's sowing the seed. He's just throwing it everywhere. The unbelievers, the believers, the fruit bearers, the non-fruit. He's just throwing out the seed. And that's going to happen again when God restarts his program out here in that tribulation period. That's what they're going to start doing, sowing the seed of the kingdom. And then that seed of the kingdom is going to bear fruit. And the fruit it bears is given in our second parable of the wheat and the tares. It's going to generate the children of the kingdom. And God's going to plant the children of the kingdom in the field of the world, over the earth, on earth, in the field of the world. Satan's world system on the earth. And the parable of the wheat and the tares, says that Satan is also going to be planting his people, the children of Satan, the children of the wicked one, in there too. So this is going to be a time, as we look at our timeline here, from the days of Jesus out to there, it's going to be a time when the wicked and the good are going to commingle. They're going to be allowed to coexist. And there's going to be a battle. Children of the wicked one are going to counteract and confront the children of God. And they're going to grow up together during this time, and especially now out in that tribulation period. During that 7 year, God's going to allow them to grow together. They weren't to separate them. They would be separated, and this takes us to the end. They'd be separated at the end when Christ returns with his angels. And then he'll, and through his angels, will separate the wheat from the tares and take the wheat into the kingdom, and the tares will be cast into fire. And that comes at the end here. So now I look at these first two parables as kind of the beginning. It's going to restart with the sowing of the seed of the kingdom, the word of the kingdom, with wild abandon. It's going to result in fruit, the children of the kingdom. God's going to plant them in the world during this time. And now the third one that we looked at is this is a time of gradual greatness. It starts out, and notice that's the emphasis of that parable of the mustard seed. It's going to start out really small, insignificant by the world standard, nothing even noteworthy. In the parable, it talks about a grain. It doesn't even say about a mustard seed. It says a grain of mustard seed. It's a speck of dust. It starts out like that, and speck of dust you just blow away. It's insignificant, doesn't amount to anything. And then he goes and emphasizes that by talking about the mustard seed that is going to grow into something great. And it's the least of all seeds. It's just a grain. It's a speck of dust. It's nothing. And it's growing into a great tree, a great bush, and then a great tree. And I believe that is a reference to the growth of the kingdom. And here we're going to develop that a little more this week and give the basis for that. Because what does that sound like? Was there another time in Israel's history when God left them as something insignificant and tiny and not noteworthy, and they grew into something great? Can you think of another time in Israel's history? And this is, I think, an important note to make for understanding the rest of the parables. There was another time this happened. It's called the Exodus account. Remember Exodus? Let's turn back there and just kind of note a couple things. I think, I'll just give you the end of the story so you can kind of see where I'm going with this, but I think the Exodus that happened back here, there's going to be another Exodus, a far larger Exodus. That was, I guess you'd say, a type of another Exodus that's going to happen at the end of this tribulation period. God is going to insert his people. It's going to be small and insignificant, and it's going to grow into greatness out in the field of the world, just like the Israelites back in history had been sent into Egypt and grew into a great nation in Egypt until God came and withdrew them from Egypt and made them his own people. So let's look at that, and let's see how this going from insignificant to gradual greatness. And then I just want you to keep in mind that every other parable here, especially the next few, all center on the Exodus account. And you'll see that as we go through them here. We're going to go all the way back to Genesis and see where the Lord made this promise to Abraham, gave this prophecy to Abraham. Go all the way back to Genesis 15. Genesis 15. I could easily get sidetracked here on Genesis 15, 6, but I'm not. I'm just going to talk about it. We've talked about that in great detail in the past. But now we're just before God makes this covenant with Abraham. He makes sure everybody in the universe realizes he's not entering into this covenant because of anything Abraham did. He's entering into this covenant with Abraham because Abraham believed God and his faith was counted for righteousness. End of story. That chapter's over. Put an exclamation point and turn the page. He begins a new chapter with Abraham, and now Abraham can participate in the earth's a prophetic program and have a privileged position in that through obedience. And we've been over that in the past, so we're not going to go on that first. But before the covenant, that's established. That's the way anyone has ever been justified, going all the way back to Adam. The only way anyone, any sinner, and of course we're all sinners, and everybody has been a sinner since the fall of Adam, the only way anyone has ever been saved before God is on the basis of faith and grace. God just comes and preaches good news to them. And when they believe, their faith is counted for righteousness, justified unto eternal life without works. And that has to be because that salvation, that justification is based, God raised up Paul to explain that, it's based on the death and resurrection of Christ. But now those who have been justified by grace through faith, now he's going to bring Abraham into a covenant. And he's going to say that Abraham can now have a privileged position in his prophetic program. And that's what we're going to see here. So now they do the sacrifices, he spread out the animals. Let's just pick it up in verse 12. This is Genesis 15, 12. Here, God is talking about how he's going to send the descendants of Jacob, the Israelites, into Egypt. Verse 12, and when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abraham, and lo, a horror of great darkness fell upon him. And he said unto Abram, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them for 400 years. Now, of course, we know this is their journey into Egypt. He's going to plant them in the nation of Egypt, in the land of Egypt. And look at how it's going to end, verse 14. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge. And that's our parable too, right? He's going to come back and separate the wheat from the tares. And afterward shall they come out of, and we can add Egypt here because we know that's what he's referring to. They're going to come out of Egypt with what? Notice that word, great substance. What's the word in our mustard seed parable? Greatness. Growing into greatness. They're going to go into the land of Egypt and they're going to grow into greatness, and they're going to be, God's going to take them out of Egypt as a great nation. Now let's pick up the fulfillment of this. Go over to Exodus 1. Exodus 1. Exodus 1. We'll just bring in at verse 1. And read down here a couple verses. Now this is 400 plus years have gone by, and now he is going to fulfill what he said to Abraham back when he made that covenant with him. This is Exodus 1, verse 1. Now these are the names of the children of Israel, which came into Egypt. Every man and his household came with Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And all the souls, note this, and all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. 70, that's how that started. 70 relations to Jacob, and they went in, that's the number that went into Egypt. Insignificant. It was, by the world standard, just something insignificant and not very large. The least of all nations, and they're going into another nation. And they're going to grow into. We don't even need to know the rest of the account. But I guess let's pick it up at verse 7 here and see how they grow to greatness. Like our mustard seed, I believe. Verse 7. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty. And the land was filled with them. What started out was 70 people. Insignificant. Egypt didn't even think about taking them in very much. And they went in there. And now, 400 plus years, and they're exceedingly abundant. They're a great nation. Verse 8. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. They're greater than them. Come on, let us deal wisely with them. And then you all know the rest of the story. They persecute them in their labor. They try to institute a program to kill their sons. And so you got all this persecution now because they've reached this greatness in the land of Israel. And now they're a threat. And God is what's God going to do next? He's going to come and he's going to deliver them out of that. And I think we have something similar here going on in that parable of the mustard seed. And let's just see how this is going to play out. If we go back to our timeline, here he is just before the cross giving this parable of the mustard seed. Now, the next time this is going to kick into effect, start to go into effect with, I guess, that wild abandon concept is going to be over at Pentecost. So let's flip over to Pentecost and see how the Pentecost account opens. And see how it opens a similar way as the Exodus account. When God starts to fulfill what he's talking about in Israel's prophetic program. Go over to Acts 1. And when this parable starts to go into effect, look what the big point at the very beginning, just before Peter and the 12 are ready to begin their ministry. Look what he writes here, Acts 1, verse 15. He gives us a number, Acts 1, verse 15. And in those days, Peter stood up in the midst of the disciples and said, and then this is really what I'm talking about here is what's in parentheses here. The number of names together were about 120. That's that believing remnant going in after the death, resurrection, and ascension of Christ. They're ready now to begin their ministry of Pentecost, and there's only 120. Small, insignificant. You can go back even before the cross, you have John coming out of the wilderness, dressed in animal skins, eating locusts, proclaiming judgment and wrath. And you have Jesus come out of Nazareth. Nothing comes good out of Nazareth, Nathanael said. Just a lowly person and a son of a carpenter and with questionable lineage and just what appears to be insignificant. And then he comes to go to a cross. He claims to be the king and he goes and he's crucified on a cross. And when you open up Acts, there's 120 people preaching a crucified Christ, a Christ, their king had been crucified, made up of a bunch of motley followers, mostly fishermen and tax collectors and things like that. And they enter into this in something insignificant by the world standard, not even worth taking the time to notice. And here they are, and now at Pentecost, Peter and the 12 are going to begin just sow the seed of the kingdom, the word of the kingdom, with wild abandon. Wild abandon. We see after that preaching that 3,000 were added. It makes a note of that in chapter 2. And yeah, missionaries who don't understand and have rejected Paul think this is a pattern for missionary work. This isn't a pattern for missionary work. This was not a good day in Israel's history. This was a horrible day in Israel's history. Someone estimated you had over 2 million Jews in Jerusalem and the surrounding area during this time of Pentecost. At least that many. We'll just use 2 million as a round number. And only 3,000 received their King and Messiah. This was not a good day of missionary work. Peter's trying, and God, the Holy Spirit, is trying to convert the whole nation, and only 3,000 respond. You know, I can, if you take 3,000 in relation to 2 million, I think that comes out to 0.15% of Israel received their king. 0.0015. No, this wasn't a good day of missionary work. This was a horrible day. And even as you go months in, someone else has estimated, I don't remember the exact chapter in Acts, but even at that point, there's just 6,000 or 7,000. No, that's a horrible missionary work. I mean, not that Peter and the 12's missionary work was bad, but that's a horrible response. The nation is going to reject Christ, their King and Messiah. All right, so that's where I think this time of gradual greatness, here it's a repeat. What's going to happen during this time is going to repeat of that Exodus account where God had sent Israel into the nation of Egypt before. He's now going to send, and we're going to see this in the next parable, actually, where he's going to put his people out in the world at this time. And it's going to start as something insignificant, inconspicuous, not noteworthy, the least of all things. And during this time, especially out here, it's going to be finished up in the day of the Lord, the tribulation period. And during that time, they're going to become so numerous, Satan's going to respond like the king of Egypt responded. And he's going to say, they've become greater than us. And Satan's kingdom is going to topple on itself because of its arrogance. All right, so let's go back to Matthew. Let's go back to Matthew's and pick from, based off that mustard seed, and setting it, that sets it up as a second Exodus. And now, when you just think back of the Exodus, what's going to be the next thing you're going to think about? You're going to think about the Passover, right? When the Exodus goes into full force. And what was repeated more and around the Passover uses this word more than any other place in the Bible. Can anyone guess what that word is? Leaven. So let's go to the next parable. The next parable, this is verse 33, Matthew 13. Verse 33. And here we're going to have a series of things associated with the Exodus. And here's one of them, leaven. All right, look at verse 33. And if some of you are missing the connection there, I'll just say that at that Passover, they were supposed to take with them unleavened bread. The leaven was excluded from Passover. All right, so now look at verse 33. Verse 33, this is Matthew 13, 33. Another parable spoke he unto them. The kingdom of heaven is like unto leaven, which a woman took and hid in 3 measures of meal till the whole was leavened. Now we're going to come to this parable, and we're going to start by sweeping out what we're thinking about. If you're thinking about literal bread, you need to sweep that out. This has nothing to do with literal bread. This is not how they would make bread in this. This isn't a baking manual. This doesn't have anything to do with bread. Now, Jesus is going to make a great point of that, and as we work our way through here in a couple other verses. And if you are thinking of in something going from very little to very large, or going from little impact, something little having a big impact, you need to sweep that out of your mind too. Sweep that out. You know what you're incorporating, what you're bringing in when you think that? You're bringing in what Paul said Paul said, a little leaven leaveneth the whole loaf. That's not what this parable says. If you read that in this parable, you're bringing in that into this parable. I just want to look at what this parable says. This is a very unusual parable. And it's not about bread or bread making, and it's not about something going from something insignificant to something great. See, most people, I'd say everybody, as far as I know in my commentaries, as far as I know, associate this parable with, let me just go back here, this parable with the parable of the mustard seed, because they're reading Paul into this passage. The mustard seed was something small and grew big. The leaven is something small and grows big. But that's not what this parable says. To read that in this parable is to bring things into this parable, read things into this parable. I just want to read this parable from the very beginning and see what Jesus is actually bringing out in this parable without bringing in anything else. So let's just start by looking at this leaven concept. And I think we're on the parable of the parable of the leaven, and let's just look and develop what's in this parable of the leaven, what it actually says, and we'll spring out from that and draw some conclusions. So parable of the leaven. He says, first of all, it's leaven. All right, so now we've swept our preconceived notions out, and we're thinking, is leaven good or is leaven bad? That's a good question to begin with. So we're going to begin, and we're not even going to turn to these passages because we're all, I think, at least superficially familiar with them. Leaven, where the word leaven is used most of the time, is at the Passover, at the Exodus, which we just talked about, that Exodus that I'm associating with that mustard seed. And that's the leaven. Now, of course, there it does have to do with bread making, and they were supposed to have unleavened bread and all that. But the leaven is there associated with something negative and corrupting. You know, the next time you read about leaven, the second most popular place for God to talk about leaven, that's in the Exodus account too. And it has to do with the sacrificial system. And leaven is excluded from the sacrificial system. It's viewed as something negative and corrupting. So when we look at the Bible as a whole and just have a clean slate in this parable, we would have to probably come to the conclusion that leaven in this parable is going to be treated as something negative and corrupting. But we have another proof that we can look at that adds much more weight to that, and that's how Matthew uses the word leaven in this context. If we flip over a couple pages, we'll see how he uses the word leaven. So go over to Matthew 16. Matthew 16, and this will, I think, assure us that we're right in concluding that leaven is something negative and corrupting. Because look what he says here in Matthew 16. Now, I really don't need these first verses of Matthew 16, but I'm going to read them anyway, because I want to bring to mind Matthew 12 again. That's a very important chapter. And remember, in Matthew 12, Jesus turns away from that wicked generation. He sends them back to John, says, go through the course again. They want a sign. Give us a sign. He's like, I've already given you a bunch of signs and you've rejected them, so I'm not going to give you another sign until I give you the sign of Jonah. Go back to John, go through the first 12 chapters of Matthew again. If you respond in faith and receive me, you'll receive the sign of Jonah, my resurrection from the dead. And if you receive the sign of Jonah, my resurrection of the dead, you'll receive the ministry of the Holy Ghost through Peter and the 12 on Pentecost, and you can escape the coming wrath. Now, Jesus then, in Matthew 12, Jesus turns away from them. And he's going to deal with his own generation, his own spiritual family. But that doesn't mean he never talks to the vain religious system again, never interacts with them. And I just want to show you what he does here when he interacts, now that he's turned away from them, how he's going to deal with them. And we pick that up in Matthew 16. So Matthew 16, verse 1. We'll just read through this quickly, and you'll see, I think, the tie-in now that I reviewed Matthew 12 with you. You'll see he's just going to repeat Matthew 12. Verse 1, the Pharisees also with the Sadducees came tempting, desired him that he would show them a sign from heaven. That's what I just reminded you, Matthew, they were doing in Matthew 12. He answered and said unto them, when this evening you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red, and in the morning it will be foul weather, for the sky is red and lowering, O you hypocrites! You can discern the face of the sky, but can ye not discern the signs of the times? The point here, like, you can discern the weather by the signs, but I've given you innumerable signs and you've rejected them. Now look how he deals with them. Verse 4, a wicked and adulterous generation. Remember that from chapter 12? The unresponsive generation, the viperous generation, the wicked, the evil and adulterous generation, and the wicked generation. And here he just summarizes it. A wicked and adulterous generation seek after a sign. There shall be no sign given until the sign of Jonas. See, he's just repeating to them what he told them in Matthew 12. But now let's get in. Now, how does he respond? He turns, remember in Matthew 12, he says, I'm turning away from you. I'm going to leave you in your ignorance. And look what he does here at the end of verse 4. And he left them and departed. He rehearses Matthew 12 with them and then leaves them and departs. And now we get into our 11 concept here, verse 5. And when his disciples were come to the other side, they had forgotten to take bread. Now, disciples have literal bread on their head, I guess you could say. Then Jesus said unto them, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, it is because we have taken no bread. See, they're still thinking about bread, literal bread. Which when Jesus perceived, he's like, why do you still have bread on your head? Get bread out of your head. I'm not talking about literal bread. And he goes on here and he says, don't you remember, that I took 5 loaves and fed the 5,000, and how many baskets you took up? Verse 10, I took 7 loaves and fed 4,000. How many baskets? He's like, I can make literal bread out of nothing. Get literal bread out of your head. I'm not talking about literal bread. Verse 11, how is it that you do not understand that I speak it not to you concerning bread, that you should beware of the leaven, but that you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Then they understood. Remember parable 1? This time's going to be characterized by instruction and understanding. They've been instructed by Jesus. They understand. Then they understood how he bade them not beware of leaven of literal bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the doctrine of the vain, the false doctrine of the vain religious system. That's that leaven. And I think that gives us overriding support then in the, if we go back to 13, to our parable. Overriding support for the fact we need to take leaven in a negative and corrupting influence, especially with regard to the leaven, the false teaching of the vain religious system. So now let's go to the next thing. So we cleared that up. This is going to be, this is referring to something that has a negative and corrupting influence. Let's go to the next thing in the parable here, which a woman took. Now, all you ladies out there, the Bible is not generally against women, but in many instances, when it comes especially in Israel's prophetic program out here, and talks about those future times, it is often referred to as a prophetic woman who's dispensing this wickedness. Not general women in general, just this prophetic woman. And we're not going to turn to all these passages. You can look these up on your own, because I think I can just mention a couple and that it'll be come to your remembrance without even turning there. You go to Revelation. We just last week, or maybe it was the week before, looked in Revelation 2 at the false prophetess, the woman, Jezebel. Later on in Revelation, you have the harlot, the woman of Babylon. And if you want to look back at Zechariah 5, which I think probably has a pretty good bearing on this parable, there again, it's talking about a woman, and she's measuring out things, has measures of things, and she's dispensing wickedness. So I think that ties in with our conclusion that leaven is negative and corrupting. And now you have this prophetic woman that's tied into various prophecies throughout the Bible, this prophetic woman who dispenses wickedness. Now let's see what she's doing here. And this is this will really tie in now with how we're to view this within the rest of the parables. So now what is she doing with this? What's the point of this parable? Now, many people say that the point of this parable is the same as that of the parable of the mustard seed, because we think leaven's small. I make bread. I make bread all the time. I have my own starter. It's really fun when you start doing it. And if I'm going to use the starter, I use about a quarter cup for 3 cups of flour. And if I use the actual dry yeast, I'd use a teaspoon and a half of yeast for 3 cups of flour. So we come in with this idea that, you know, he's talking about a little bit of yeast that's going to cause the whole loaf, the whole lump to grow. But you see, we got to pick up what Jesus said in chapter 6. He's not talking about bread. This has nothing to do with bread making. If you followed what that parable said, you couldn't make bread. This parable, this woman, what's she doing here? She's hiding the leaven in 3 measures of meal. She's not hiding the leaven in a lump of dough. There's no water here. She's hiding the leaven in the wheat seed. She's putting the yeast in the middle of the wheat. Dry wheat. This is meal. This is the wheat seed. Well, what's the wheat seed? The wheat and the tares, the good seed, the word of the kingdom, the seed, the children of the kingdom, the wheat. It's the children of that kingdom. It's the children of the kingdom. She's going to hide. She's going to start hiding a corrupting influence in amongst the wheat seed, the children of the kingdom. And it's going to, how long is it going to be there? God's going to allow this to happen until, the end of verse 33, until the whole measure is leaven, till the whole measure is people. God's whole people are going to be affected by the false teaching of this vain religious system, the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the vain religious system, and Satan's policy of evil against the Israel, that believing remnant, as they go through that tribulation period. So I believe that's what the parable of the leaven is talking about. During this time, the kingdom will be characterized by Satan hiding his leaven, that doctrine of the vain religious system, among the wheat seed, the children of the kingdom, and it's going to permeate until it has an effect. They're going to try and deceive the whole people of God. There's even a point where it's going to be said that it would draw all of God's people away from him, where it's possible. Paul even talks about that. All right. So in the Bible, leaven is always something negative and corrupting. Let's go to that. Negative and corrupting. Negative and corrupting. And so based on everything we've seen there, and in this prophecy, the one who spreads wickedness is often portrayed as a prophetic woman, and I think that fits this parable perfectly. And she's going to be inserting that in these measures of wheat until it has an effect on all the children of God. The children of the kingdom. She would be allowed to hide her leaven in the wheat until it affected the 3 measures. So the only thing we have to talk about is what is this 3 measures? If we went back to the woman in Zechariah, she is dealing there with 3 measures of things. And there it seems to especially associate with the land of Israel. So if we work off that, we could say these 3 measures would be the children of the kingdom in Jerusalem and Judea. You know, Jerusalem's in Judea. And then it's going to expand to the children of the kingdom in Samaria. And then that would expand to the children of the kingdom out in among the nations. Remember, Israel has yet to occupy the land promised by Abraham, promised by God to Abraham. They came closest in the days of David and Solomon, but they never even reached the outer land. So here, what this could be to these three meals of the children in the king of the kingdom in Jerusalem and Judea, it could be the children, as that's going to expand to the children of the kingdom in Samaria, and then the greater part of Israel out among the outer rim of there to the full extent of Israel. That could be one explanation. But there's another explanation. If we kind of pick it up in the Acts account, what's the ministry of this believing remnant? Where are they going to start? They're going to start in Jerusalem and Judea. Then it's going to go out to Samaria. And then where does it go? It goes out to the uttermost parts of the earth. And my preference is to take those three measures. If we have to try and assign exactly what they're referring to, I think it's referring more to the three measures. You got Jerusalem and Judea. It's going to rise there. It's going to spread out to the greater Israel. And then it's going to spread out to the children of the kingdom out scattered among the nations. And all you got to do is see that vain religious system working by reading James, which we dealt with, and then also Peter and John. Okay. All right, so that's the parable of the kingdom. That's what one's referring to. It's all tied to the Exodus account. And now let's look at our chart here. Notice I've put these in kind of a staggering look to them. And I'm doing this for an important purpose, because now we're going to see something that happens. If we get away from the traditional way these parables are lined up, usually the leavened one is lined up with the mustard one. But I think hopefully I've demonstrated, you don't have to agree with me or follow me, but hopefully I've demonstrated my biblical basis for that. And I'm suggesting that the leaven isn't a sister parable to the mustard seed. The leaven is a sister parable to the next parable. So let's go take a look at that one now. And then we're just going to introduce that. And I'm just going to bring that out here now. When we keep in mind that the main thrust of the parable of the leaven is not something that's insignificant and small turning into something great. What's important in the parable of the Lebanon is that somebody's hiding something. It's the hiding concept. Now, let's read the next parable, verse 44, Matthew 13, 44, and see if you see a tie-in here. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto treasure, what? Hid in a field. The which, when a man hath found, he hides, and for joy. Notice the hide there again. A treasure hid in the earth. And a man finds, and he hides. The issue, the emphasis of this parable is not really even on the treasure. It's on the hiding. And that's what was happening in the parable of the leaven, too. It's not so much about leaven or bread. It's about this woman is going to be hiding the leaven of the false religious system to corrupt all the children of God. And now in this parable, this, I believe, is the sister parable to the leaven, and that's the parable of the treasure hidden in the field. And we'll expand on that. But first, let's just kind of, with this in mind, these four, let's just bring out a couple points about these. In these first four parables, remember, these first four parables are going to have been spoken. Jesus spoke these before the multitudes. Now in the next four parables, he's going to speak them just to his disciples. He's going to turn away from even the multitudes and teach and talk only to the and instruct the disciples. So we have here in these first four parables, if we stop and take a look at them, I think we have something that's already begun in Jesus' day. We have a foretaste of these first four parables in Christ's earthly ministry, and it's going to also even be more so as a foretaste in the ministry of Peter and the 12, through the ministry of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost in early Acts. But I just put a few examples here. You could go and fill this in and probably make charts several pages long. But just to kind of get the idea, you had the parable of the sower. That was the prepared and unprepared soils. And we can just look at Matthew 12 and see he's turning away from that wicked generation. And he's pulling out his own generation. The tares and the wheat. All you need to do, look at Judas, right? Judas was numbered among the 12. And then he eventually went to his death. The mustard seed. There is the idea of an insignificant beginning. You have there, you know, Christ from Nazareth. Nothing good comes from Nazareth, Nathaniel said. Son of a carpenter, questionable lineage, and he's going to go be crucified on a cross, on a Gentile Roman cross. What kind of a king is that? That doesn't sound like a very hopeful king. So very small beginnings, and he calls out a group, not out of the religious system, not the erudite and the intelligent, or not the intellectual and all that. He pulls them out. These are fishermen and tax collectors and other kinds of sinners and things like that. And he starts from something insignificant, just like he did when he sent the Israelites into Egypt. He's going to send these, he is 70 going into Egypt. Here you have 120 he's going to send out to the world. And out of that, poor beginning, insignificant, nothing by the world, set as a speck of dust, you blow off your hand and it's going to grow. And by the time Satan realizes what's going on, it's going to be so big, like the king of Egypt, it's going to cause Satan and his kingdom to topple on itself. Leaven. And we've seen nothing, we've been talking about nothing but practically since the first chapters of Matthew, the leaven of the corrupt teaching of the vain religious system. And so there, I think that these are ones that take into effect. Now the next set is going to refer to things that come later. And that's what we'll bring out when we go into the next four. So these first four parables are spoken to the multitudes. They're explained to the disciples. They began in the days of Christ himself and were foretasted at Pentecost and will reach their fulfillment during the tribulation and second coming of Christ. All right, so with that background, let's enter into the next four, which now just keep in mind, he's not talking to the multitudes anymore. He's going to turn around, he goes back in the house, and he's going to teach them some more parables. So, okay, let's read the parable of the treasure now, and let's realize that the main thrust of this parable is not even the treasure. The main thrust of this pair, the action of the verbs, is the concept of hiding. And it's mentioned twice. Let's read it again. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto treasure hidden in a field, the which when a man hath found, he hideth. Here we have, it's a treasure hidden in a field. And when a man finds, he hideth. And for joy thereof goeth and selleth all that he hath, and buyeth that field. All right, so here we have the parable of the kingdom. I think this is a sister parable. That's why I put it up here again, of the leaven. It's the one, those two go together. While this woman is hiding leaven among the wheat seed, in the wheat, in this parable, God is going to be hiding this treasure in the earth. They're going to both be hiding things. And that's what we'll take a look at now. What is this treasure? This is an activity that's going to happen. It's going to cover this time. It's going to characterize the time between the first and second coming of Christ. and he's going to talk about this treasure. Now, if we want to understand, remember where we left, a mustard seed, I kind of tied into the Exodus account, and then the next parable was about what? Leaven? Where do you go to learn about, hear the most about leaven? The Exodus account. And then we looked at, now we look at here at this treasure concept. Guess where you go to have your first reference to treasure? Or at least the God's special mention of treasure, the Exodus account. Let's go back to, Exodus. This time in Exodus 19. Exodus 19. And let's see what God calls his people here. What God calls his people. Exodus 19, we've just gone through the Exodus. The nation that was insignificant was planted in, just like our wheat and tares, was planted in the land of Egypt, and they grew into greatness. And now God's delivered them from the Egyptians, out of that world of the Egypt, and now he's brought them to himself as on eagle's wings. And brought them to himself. And look how he describes them. Verse 5. Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar what? A peculiar treasure unto me above all people. For all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. The children of Israel, that same Exodus account, that's the core of the mustard seed, the core of that leaven, is now the core of this treasure. That's where he describes the nation of Israel. They are going to be his treasure. And I have a couple other verses here we could look at from Psalm 17. I'll let you look up that on your own. Deuteronomy 32:10. It just God over and over shows that this people of Israel, the apple of his eye, it's a sensitive part. He's going to watch them. He's going to care for them. Even when Moses goes to see his glory, the God protected him and cared for him by covering him, hiding him in the rock. This hiding concept, while this wicked woman is hiding the leaven of the vain religious system amongst the wheat, the children of the kingdom, God hasn't forgotten them. God isn't ignoring them. God has them. They're the apple of his eye. He's going to hide them in the world. And at times, especially that last 3.5 years, he's going to hide them, bring them out to a wilderness and hide them and in the clefts of the mountains and hide them. That's while she's doing her work of corrupting, he's going to preserve and protect his treasure, the children of Israel. And of course, at this point, that's going to be made up of that believing remnant.